Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 726 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Valiant Sunday episode, and I'm going to be returning to the chronology with Harbinger number 8 from writer Joshua Dysart. We have art by Lee Garbett, colors by Moose Bauman, letters by Rob Steen. So if you remember last time, issue 7, we saw the Renegades begin to form. We saw Chris Hathaway, Faith Hebert, and Peter Stanchek go and recruit somebody from New Orleans, a young woman by the name of Charlene Dupree that was working as a stripper. And Pete was able to unlock her latent psionic powers, which were flame-based in nature. So as this new issue starts off, issue 8, we see somebody walking along a road underwater. There's a sunken battleship, and this person is sort of narrating the story, telling us through some dialogue boxes that here's the deal. There's a place I go to, a place only I can see. It's kind of a dream place, and it lives inside of me, and there's a road there, and for some reason the road's underwater, under the Sea of Woe, as he calls it. And he starts talking about how the road is always where he starts his kick-ass adventures, and he can breathe down there because the Cardassian mermaids give him their air, and there's lots of hot bitches here in Torkhalla, is what he calls this land, as he strides up out of the water into a reddish sky with lightning crashing down. And this hulking figure of a man says that the land here always smells like sweet, sweet ass, and the gods tremble at the sight of him. So it's kind of clear by the vocabulary, the pop culture references, that this is somebody who's not necessarily that well educated, but is clearly into pop culture, into celebrity, and the whole sort of reality television, celebrity status of the day, which makes me wonder. I mean, it's okay now. It does feel a little dated. This issue did come out in 2013, so 6 years ago. But I do wonder, you know, I'm always wary when writers put in a lot of pop culture references because it does root the story in a particular time period and they don't always age well. On the next page, we see a big empty space. It's Southeast Oregon. It's called the Regal Goods Ranch. It's 135,000 acres, a hidden subsidiary of Redding Livestock International, which in itself is one of 200 shielded assets belonging to Harada Global Conglomerates. It's a no-fly zone designated by the U.S. government because of initiatives funded by Harada Global Conglomerate Environmental Slush Funds. So basically, it's a hideout. It's a hideout for Harada, and there's no satellites flying over. There's no, you know, air traffic flying over because that's the way Harada wants it, because it's a prison in a way, and it's where Harada has stashed Livewire after she betrayed him and allowed Pete Stanchek to escape. So we see Harada flying in a force bubble, calling out to Amanda, and that would be, of course, Livewire Amanda McKee. And in the little blurb that gives us the information about her, it says she's been decommissioned. And again, he calls out to her and she responds, Harada Sama, and kneels before him. And he says, you're prisoner in exile. You don't have to kneel. But Amanda surprisingly says, well, you know what? You're still my master. And Harada says, you know, I'm surprised you haven't tried to walk out of here yet. Not that she necessarily would be successful. But Amanda says, you know what? To be honest, the silence can be quite beautiful, but it also can be lonely. Come inside. I'm making tea. Again, remember that Amanda McKee has the ability to hear machines. So when she's in civilization, so to speak, there's always noise. There's always white noise, static. She's hearing radio waves and television waves and other forms of communication and devices talking back and forth to one another. Out here in the middle of nowhere, she can finally have some peace. So as Harada walks inside, she asks him, how goes the world? And he mentions this private energy deal that he's a part of, which is the biggest in human history, and how he's pouring a lot of his resources into trying to stabilize post-rebellion Syria, and also this teenage junkie that's taxing his organization and his time. And clearly he's referring to Peter Stanchek. And that sparks Amanda's interest. She says, well, you know, I would never speak out against you when I was your first in command, but you know, now that I'm not, basically, you handled Peter Stanchek poorly from the beginning. And that's kind of why Harada is there, because he does feel that Amanda has a better understanding of Pete than he ever will. And we'll find out the reason for that in a second here. But Harada goes on to say, he's recruiting Psyots, Amanda. He's activating helpless children who have no idea how to use their powers. It's the worst case scenario. It's rogue, undisciplined, unaffiliated, untrained harbingers out there in the world. And Amanda says, well, I understand the danger of that, but I know you blame me, but really you should look to yourself. And Harada interrupts saying, how old were you when I pulled you out of that state orphanage? When I came to you and I educated you and I gave you great power? So a little passive aggressive on Harada's part, maybe even not so passive, but reminding her that he is the reason that she is who she is. And she responds, I was 13, and she starts to see herself that way as that young child. And she says, I feel you inside my mind. You've never... And Harada says, we're not in your mind, Amanda. We're in mine. And his body sort of morphs, and he wraps her up with his arms, which have turned into these tentacle-like appendages. And he says, I don't understand Peter. He's irrational to me, but you understood him from the start. I need to know what you know. You were like him once, gutter trash. And again, that's why Harada feels that Amanda always understood Peter. They come from the same place, a place that Harada will always look down on. They didn't have families. They were, Amanda was an orphan. Pete was given up by his mother after he inadvertently lobotomized his father. And so there's an understanding there, having these two people come from a similar background. And Harada goes on to say, in the absence of the monk, because we know the bleeding monk left Harada recently, you are my counsel. Peter has this recruitment list, but I can't watch every latent Psyot in America, so I'm going to dig it out of you with a psychic scalpel. Where do you think the boy's going next? And Amanda's like, you don't need to dig it out of me. And you don't have to watch every potential. He won't go after the eligibles, just like you said. He's a piece of litter. He'll go after the losers. And I guess that finally makes sense to Harada, because he leaves quickly, leaving Amanda lying there on the floor saying, Master, as she's curled up in the fetal position. She speaks after him, saying, the ones you have the least regard for. He'll look for the weakest in hopes that he can give them strength. Meanwhile, in the backwoods of Chattanooga County, Georgia, we see a brick cinder block building, Torx Auto Shop, it says, across the top. And we see a guy in there working on a truck. And he sort of resembles the figure we saw striding along the road under the Sea of Woe. And Charlene heads in saying, anyone home? And this guy kind of speaks like that figure we saw marching across the road as well. Holy miracles, girl, where did you come from? And Charlene says, well, I fell from heaven. Me and some friends are looking for a guy named Torkelson. You him? And this guy says, they look like you, them friends? And Charlene's response is, nobody looks like me, baby. I'm a snowflake. And Torkelson's response is, cold as ice? And Charlene sort of shakes her head. One of a kind, dumbass. And the guy responds, well, unless you're a lawyer, I'm your man, Jay Torkelson. And as he walks outside and sees Chris and Peter there, Chris says, really? This is the guy? When do we get to meet the genius physicist harbingers? Again, Chris kind of looking down on the people that Pete is choosing to recruit. And I love the voice that Joshua Dysart always gives Chris. She's always there with a cutting remark, you know, smartest one in the room, and really in over her head, aware of the fact that she's in over her head. She's too smart not to understand that. And it's sort of her defense mechanism to make these remarks, you know, kind of her armor, if you will. So as Jay Torkelson strides outside, he says, hey, a straw boy. No wonder you girls came looking for a real man. And Pete takes one look at him and says, that's not him. And Chris is like, oh, thank God. It's all we need is this redneck, right? And Pete, his eyes glowing, says, you're Jake Torkelson, but you got a brother, right? Where? Oh, yeah, I got it. He's in the back. And Pete starts walking around the auto shop saying, stay here for a sec, guys. I'm just going to make sure everything's cool. And Jake's like, hey, where the hell you think you're going? Pete turns back, looks over his shoulder, eyes glowing, saying, Jake, go find your feminine side. And we see the look on Jake's face in the next panel. He's very contemplative. And Pete's like, man, I'm so torn on the ethics of that, right? Like, Chris had her mind invaded. So, you know, she's not necessarily going to condone that type of behavior. But at the same time, she knows that this guy, Jake Torkelson, really could use a touch of sensitivity, if you will. You know, a little more balance in his ego, if you will. So Pete continues to walk around the side of the auto shop saying, be right back. And as he is walking, he calls out to Faith telepathically saying, Faith, you out there? And Faith is flying above the forest that's near the auto shop saying, call me Zephyr, call me Zephyr. Pete says, fine, Zephyr, how's it look? And Faith's like, oh, it's all clear, not a soul around. Flamingo and you and Chris, and that's it. Ain't nobody else here but us chickens. And Pete says, good, you know, stay vigilant and keep an eye out. Let me know if there's anybody in sight. And so as Pete walks back to the trailer that's up on some blocks behind the auto shop, he calls out to John Torkelson and says, I met your brother outside. He said I could come talk to you. And we see a closed bedroom door and a voice behind it saying, go away. I ain't got to talk to no one. And Pete says, that's true, but I promise this conversation is going to be pretty interesting. And he says, don't freak out. I'm coming in. And the voice off panel says, what the hell, man? And we see that it's a guy who's laying in bed. And it appears that his legs and arms are extremely thin. And he doesn't look to be in the best shape. And he's also thinking to himself that there ain't no stars in Torkhalla. Some powerful sorcerer snuffed them out a long time ago. And there ain't no free men here neither. Overlord made slaves of them all but me. And as he's thinking, as he's in that dreamland, he's driving some massive monster truck with a giant demon skull on the front. And he's thinking to himself that life in Torkhalla ain't nothing but fighting bastards and banging hotties. And one day the battling and the banging is going to come to an end. But on that day, he'll still be standing. And it becomes clear that this land of Torkhalla is sort of the imaginary place of this young kid who appears to be crippled in some way. And back in the real world, he's yelling at Pete to get out of his room. And Pete says, look, I'm sorry for barging in. I knew you couldn't answer the door. And are you watching reruns of Jersey Shore? And again, this guy, John Torkelson, is he has nothing but his imagination and, you know, crappy daytime television. And so it's not surprising that the imaginary world he lives in is inhabited by Kardashian mermaids. And he makes these pop culture references. And he thinks that being a man is, you know, fighting and banging hot bitches. You know, he feels like he's something less than a person because of his disability, because of his inability to get out there and interact. And because of his physical issues, to him, being strong, being powerful means physical strength. He doesn't make that connection with being mentally strong, and making something of himself mentally would mean he's just as strong as this torque that inhabits Torkhalla. So it's a very understandable defense mechanism, and it's understandable why he has sort of the visions that he does, the dreams that he does. It's all he knows. It's all he knows in terms of the way he was raised and the environment that he's in, what it means to be a man, the limitations and the disabilities that he himself has, and how he hopes to, or how he imagines he wants life to be. You know, he wants to be a big, physically imposing specimen who listens to, you know, hard rock and heavy metal music, and has all these attractive women flock to him, and nobody messes with him because he's strong. And he has the celebrity that comes along with being a reality TV star, right? that fleeting celebrity. But to him, you know, living in the trailer in the backwoods of Georgia seems a lot, you know, that seems a much better deal than what he has. So Pete goes on to say, so you're crippled? Yeah, what's wrong with you? And Torkelson doesn't give him a straight answer, just says, I'm a freaking freak, you freak. I got toothpicks for legs. It sucks. And Pete says, well, you know, my plan this time around was to be a lot more cautious. And he's referring to what happened with burning down the motel with Charlene inadvertently. And Pete says, goes on to say, but I think I can help you here, you know, make your life better. And that Torkelson at that point rolls his eyes and says, oh, you're a doctor. Jesus. Screw you, man. Just leave me alone. And Pete says, I know. it's a crazy pitch to get out of the blue, but I don't know how else to say it. And I don't know exactly what I can do for you, but whatever it is, it's got to be better than this, right? And Torkelson, you know, he starts considering it. And he says, can you make it so, you know, I can rev the engine? So clearly whatever's wrong with Torkelson is affecting him sexually as well. He's not able to, you know, have any feeling or perform anything in that way. And again, this guy has been experiencing life through a television, and he's also at that age of raging hormones, despite whatever limitations his body has. And so it's not surprising that that would be something that he would consider. And if that's the case, then maybe he's willing to take the chance. Meanwhile, above the forest, Faith sees some helicopters heading in, three of them. She says she's going to go below the tree line so they don't see her, and she'll keep Pete posted. And as we see Pete back in John Torkelson's room, he's put his hand on Torkelson's head, and Torkelson's thinking, it's weird. I haven't had anybody touch me since Mama died except for Jake, and Jake hates it. He says, I'm gross, so I try not to bother him. And we get a little bit of the real John Torkelson there, right? The one that kind of feels sorry for himself and feels alone and isolated, and it's not the tough guy, leave me alone act that he showed to Peter. So Torkelson goes on to say, this guy, he's starting to make me feel all, I don't know. And meanwhile, outside, as the helicopters are approaching Faith, she thinks, I don't feel well. And then all of a sudden, her powers go away, and she grabs onto a tree branch to try to keep from falling. She says, I think I'm going to be sick. And the tree branch cracks, and she falls to the ground. Meanwhile, Chris and Charlene have heard the noise, the helicopters, and they're wondering what it could be. And all of a sudden, Chris says, something's wrong with my head. We see Charlene getting sick, and Chris is like, oh no, they found us. The helicopters are saying, Gray Leader, we have a visual on Hathaway. They released these synaptic bombs that start going off. And again, Charlene's feeling really sick. And we get a flashback to 5 days ago in New Orleans after the events that happened in the parking lot of the strip club that Charlene worked at. And it's Charlene and Chris, and they're talking about what actually happened. And Chris is saying, wow, your skin looks really good. Those burns that we saw when you first manifested your powers are gone. And Charlene says, you know, they weren't actually burns. It was just this like charred layer, and it scrubbed right off in the shower, and my skin's better than ever. And it's amazing having these powers. I feel like I have all this energy. And Chris is like, well, that's good, because, you know, we had our doubts about activating people. And I know Pete's trying to play it cool, but he's actually really freaked out. And yeah, we're unsure of ourselves. And Charlene's like, well, that's sweet to hear you think about Pete's feelings, because it seems like most of the time you don't like him very much. And Chris is like, well, don't go down that road, because it's super complicated. But I do want to know if you're going to road trip with us or what. And Charlene's, well, what am I going to do around here? Keep dancing for dollars? Kill Huxley before he kills me? And Chris is like, well, you don't have to stay here. We could give you money. You could go away if you wanted. Charlene's all, yeah, where'd you get money from? Being a smartass pays a premium? And Chris is like, we robbed a bank. And I love the reaction of Charlene. What, girl? I wish you liked me more, because I sure as hell like you. And Chris goes on to say, well, I'm actually a little worried about it, because we did it so blatantly and so obvious, and I made a spectacle of it, and we haven't seen it anywhere on the news. And Charlene's like, well, that's cool. You got away with it, right? And Chris is like, no, it means something bad. I don't know what yet, but something, right? Like, that's not normal. And anything not normal is going to worry Chris at this point. And so Charlene's like, so you're trying to bribe me to not be in your crew now that you kind of see me and now that I have powers? And Chris's like, no, it's not that at all. It's just this life that we have, you've got to choose it with full understanding, because the thing is, we're spoiling for a fight and it's going to be a hard one. And Charlene seems a little doubtful. She's like, oh yeah, who are you going to fight? And I don't know why Chris chooses to use this term. Like, why didn't she just say, you know, it's this powerful corporation or whatever, but instead she goes, you know, it's going to sound stupid when I say it out loud, but we're going to fight the man. And Charlene gets a kick out of that, starts laughing and clapping and says, well, hell, let's do that. Like, she is totally in. She doesn't have anyone, so it's not surprising that she would want to go along with the Renegades and have someone to rely on, have someone who has her back and whose back that she has. I don't think she's ever had that in her whole life. And it's interesting to stop and think. And I talked about it when we discussed last issue about how I would love to have gotten more solo time with Charlene, with Flamingo, because I think there's a lot there. I think she's a very underrated character in a lot of ways, and I think there's a lot of richness there. So meanwhile, back in the forest outside near the auto body shop, Charlene's yelling, oh my God, what are they doing to my head? We see Jake Torkelson come out of his garage saying, get back, ladies. I'm going to teach these boys some manners. And he's holding what looks to be an M16, and he's wearing a dress. So apparently the get in touch with your feminine side by Pete meant to him, go put on a dress. And Chris is worried the air is getting hot. She's not able to breathe, and it's because Charlene is starting to manifest her powers. So she's sucking up all the oxygen as she starts to burn. And Chris is yelling out to her, you've got to stay in control. I'm too close. You know, I don't want to get burned up, basically. And the scene shifts back to Torkala, with Tork saying, I don't know how to explain it, but this Doogie Howser dude, he's all up in my head. And as soon as he put his hands on me, I went straight to Torkala without even thinking about it. And it's not like any of my dreams of Torkala either. This is like the realest real it's ever been. And it's nothing but the most badass Megadeth songs playing from the very sky itself. And even when I can feel, like, from very, very far away that he's taking his hands off me, I'm still there. I'm still in Torkala. And as Pete lets go, he says, something's wrong. It feels like that first night, that night back home. And he realizes it's phased electromagnetic pulses, which means Project Rising Spirit. So meanwhile, Charlene basically explodes into flame as Chris is trying to run away. But before the explosion can reach Chris, we see Pete zoom in a force field, scoop up Chris and envelop her in the force field as well, as the flames and explosion of Flamingo sort of overtake them. Meanwhile, John Torkelson is full on in Torkala, and he's being interviewed by a TV crew with talks of him getting his own reality show. And there's a woman at his feet who hears a voice from below saying, help. And she says, ooh, what is that? And as Tork turns and he sees his real body lying there on the ground, he says, shut up, that's me. And he starts to cry, and the woman says, oh, it's raining from your eyes. And this large Torkelson says, you know, I've never seen myself before. I must have washed up from the sea of woe, and it makes me so sad to look at me, to look at the real me, right? The broken down me. And he goes down there and he picks up his body and he says, come on, little man, I'll take care of you. That's it. You'll be safe in here. And as he opens his shirt, we see that his chest is just a star field. And the real John Torkelson, the crippled body, says, whoa, the stars. I found the stars of Torkala. And in the real world, we see Torkelson bust out of the trailer. And it's that big hulking Tork of Torkala as he leaps into the sky toward the helicopters. The helicopters notice him coming, and Tork is saying, Torkala never felt like this before. I'm inside. I'm safe inside this body. It's like I'm in some kind of shell, and I'm inside my idea. Me, the cripple, inside the perfect man. whether or not Torque is the perfect man is, you know, a subject for debate. But clearly, in the world, in the environment that this crippled boy, John Torkelson, has grown up in, this is his idea. This is his somewhat immature idea of what a perfect man is. Somebody who's big, somebody who's muscular, somebody who wins the fights, wins the bar brawls, and has women falling at his feet. So as he leaps toward the helicopter, the crippled body inside this shell of this Torque body, he thinks to himself, I hope in hell I never have to wake up in the real world again. Thank you, Doogie Howser. Thank you. So he lands on the front of one of the helicopters, starts punching his way through the windshield, and one of the other helicopters says, hey, shoot him down, take him out of the sky. He's like, you want me to shoot at one of our own? He says, yes, I said down that chopper. Blitzkrieg those kids. And so he opens fire, and the helicopter does go crashing to the ground, but Torque is unhurt by that. We do see that Charlene runs away from the helicopter that's falling from the sky, and she hides under an old broken down pickup truck. The other two helicopters are trying to get a bearing on where Pete is. And finally they say, you know what? Enough talking, just light up everything. And they fire some missiles at the trailer. They fire some missiles at the automotive garage. And meanwhile, we see that Pete and Chris are safe, still inside that force bubble that Pete created to save them from Charlene's blast. And Chris is wondering where Charlene and Faith are. And Pete says, I'll go and find them, stay here. And Chris says, no, Pete, it's not safe. They're scrambling our brains back there. They're raining fire on us. One of us is going to get killed if we don't pull back. But it won't be you. It's going to be me, or it's going to be Faith, or it's going to be Charlene. So, you know, we need to retreat. And Pete says, you know, they're not going to let us retreat, Chris. They're going to keep coming after us. And Chris is trying to convince him, saying, no, we need to retreat. We need to find a better position. We need to be the ones that are dictating the terms of the fight. Work as a team or we're screwed. Again, Chris is the voice of reason. She understands this. Pete, he's much more reactionary. He's much more impulsive. And Chris is able to convince him by saying, listen to me, Pete. Can you tell them, just them, and not let PRS hear? And Pete says, I can try. And so he reaches out with his mind. He says, everyone tune in. You too, Torkelson. We've got to make a run for it, but we need to do it organized to throw them off. Run in a different direction, pull their attention away from each other. And Torque is thinking, you know, I don't understand how this can be real. Because if this is Torkhalla, how can it hurt so much? And then he's starting to realize maybe this isn't Torkhalla at all. And Pete says, everybody just run. I'll find you when it's safe. And Charlene continues to hide under that rundown pickup truck. And we also see a scene of Faith in the clearing in the woods where she fell from the tree, and she's apparently still unconscious as Pete is imploring everybody to run to make their escape. And that's how the issue ends, and we get the blurb next, have faith, for that is where your strength lies. So a really jam-packed issue. We met the next member of the Renegades, John Torkelson, or Torque, who was never really my favorite. I feel like he, in a way, is the most different from the Torque of the original Valiant. It's an interesting idea that Joshua Dysart came up with, of having this crippled boy inside this indestructible shell, what he considers to be the perfect man. But there's so many tropes and so much misogyny and everything, and I wonder if Josh would still go that far and in that same direction if he were writing it now. We know there's already a few things he would change, so I'm curious about that as well. It might be in today's sort of post-Me Too political and societal environment that maybe Torkelson could be not quite swing that far over to misogyny and sexism and that kind of thing, because it does leave a little bit of a bad taste in your mouth. He is supposed to be a good guy, so to speak. You know, he is supposed to be a hero, but at the same time, he's human and he's young and he's immature. And so, you know, some of those things may be a product of that. But again, that being said, even at the time I was reading it, it didn't really sit that well with me. He's not really like John Torkelson as he is, and nothing to do with his disability, but he's not really the kind of person that I would consider that I would be friends with, only because of that wall that's put up and, you know, the fact that he lives in this fantasy world and just his ideas, his sort of backwards way of thinking in terms of women and what makes a perfect man and things like that. And again, I'm not saying anything bad about Torkelson as a person. I just think, again, it's a product of his environment and the way he was raised, losing his mother early and his brother, you know, not even wanting to touch him, saying he's gross because of his physical ailments. And we have no idea who his father is, you know, and that may very well be where a lot of this misogyny and backwards thinking comes from, is the fact that he never really had any positive male role models. You know, he's getting his role models, male role models, from watching the Jersey Shore, right? I mean, what do you expect? So an interesting character, but one that I don't know that I really ever cared for or ever really will care for that much. And the other part of it is just that he is so ingrained into this early 2000s era. Like I said, with the Kardashian mermaids and watching Jersey Shore and everything. And again, I just don't know how well that's going to age. So I wonder, and don't get me wrong, I love Harbinger, love Joshua Dysart. He's an incredible writer. But if there's one thing that I could go back and change about Harbinger, this might be it. Just Torque in general. I think it could have been handled differently and been, for me, more interesting. And maybe it spoke to people. Maybe there's a reason that Josh chose to do it this way. I've never actually sat down and talked with Josh about Torque, so that might be something that we'll have to do at some point. But again, as far as the action, it's nonstop in this issue, and the Lee Garbett art is awesome. I particularly love the sort of the talking head moments between Pete and Torkelson. I love the expressions that Lee gives to Pete. We can tell how nervous Pete is to activate Torque based on what happened with activating Charlene. The scene in the diner, the flashback scene in the diner between Chris and Charlene, has some great character moments, great facial expressions as well. So yeah, I really love the Lee Garbett art. And if you love Garbett art as much as I do, he's only gotten better over time, and his current work on the Skyward series is excellent. So I do recommend that. But as far as the characters in this book, again, Garbett does a great job of showing emotion, great transitions from panel to panel, and it really sort of ties in with how much these characters are starting to evolve. I feel like in the first arc, where we really meet Pete, we meet Harada, we find out about the Harada Global Conglomerates Corporation, that was sort of the getting to know you phase, and we didn't see a lot of characterization or character growth or evolution. But as soon as this second arc starts, as soon as the Renegade arc starts, we start to see a lot of evolution, a lot of growth from these characters, with Pete deciding not to die, with Chris deciding that she's going to throw in with Pete and attempt to stop Harada in whatever way they can. Faith starts becoming more confident, growing into the Faith that is a huge popular character in the Valiant universe. So it's really in this second arc, it's really in this Renegades arc, where we start to see these characters really grow and mature and kind of come into their own. Do they still make mistakes? Do they still make bad decisions? Sure, they are still kids at the end of the day. They haven't been doing this anywhere near as long as Harada, and they don't always make the best choice based on the situation. And that also makes it realistic, because again, they're in a situation where they don't have experience. There's no one to guide them. So it does make sense that mistakes would still be made, but you can see them trying. You can see them thinking things through. They're no longer just reacting. They have decided to sort of seize their own destiny in a way, rather than have their decisions handed to them or be forced upon them. They're trying to take back some level of freedom, some level of self-determination. And that starts with deciding to recruit more Psyots and hopefully create an army of their own to combat Harada. So again, I love this story. I can't recommend Harbinger enough. I think it's the single best title that Valiant's ever put out, both the 90s version and the 2012 version of Valiant. Nothing has surpassed it in my mind to this point. That's not to say that it won't happen eventually, but I really love this title, and I would recommend it to anybody who likes a good story, whether they're a comic book reader or not. So I think that's going to do it for this episode. Hope you all enjoyed this look back at Harbinger 8. I want to remind everybody to please tell your friends about our podcast. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever podcast app you use on your mobile device. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple, which really raises our podcast on the list. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.